Welcome back, everyone, to the 13th episode of Aspire, the Leadership Development Podcast, where we will be discussing the visions, inspirations, and experiences from top educational leaders. My name is Joshua Stamper, and you can connect with me on Twitter or on Instagram at Joshua_Stamper. This week, I'm very excited to be joined by Brian Aspina, leadership speaker, teacher in Ontario, Canada, blogger, and author of Codebreaker. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure's all mine. Happy Friday.
Brian, as you know, the show is centered on leadership development. Your journey is a little bit different than my previous guest, which I absolutely love. But will you just share with the listeners your personal leadership journey?
Yeah, absolutely. It started for me about 13, 14 years ago when I studied computer science and I just decided, you know what, I loved school as a kid. I always said I wanted to be a teacher. So I went back to join the faculty of ed and luckily got hired at a teacher's college and spent 12 years in the formal K-8 space, both as a classroom teacher and occasional administrator. And these days I teach teachers at faculty of ed here at a couple of universities in Ontario.
Teaching smaller children versus the adults, what's the big difference there?
You know what? There's a few big differences. Number one, kids are eager to try new things. They're not as apprehensive. I'll put that out there. I'm not saying teachers are not, but certainly in some of my adult courses, fear's not the right word, but a little bit more apprehensive to try some, especially with the technology side, because I do teach, it's called ICT, Integration of Information and Computer Technology, as well as some math courses. And, you know, both of those can be intimidating to people. There's a difference between some of the adult courses that I have as well, because I do teach, they're called three-part courses in Ontario. So you're part one, you're part two, and then your specialist course. And it's interesting to watch the adults in the part one course in terms of pedagogy versus the adults in the part three course, because you can't take a part three course here in Ontario without a minimum of, I believe it's 2 years teaching experience. So a lot of the people in the part one courses are early 20s, typically straight out of the faculty. And in terms of the differences, the conversations, when we talk particularly in math, those in the part ones, having just come out of the system, have more of a focus on grades. And those in the part three have more of a focus on feedback. And then that just comes with experience and, you know, being in the system. But what it says to me is that those in the part one have literally just come from a grade-driven system. So we still have work to do.
No, that's great insight, because you think of an adult, you think you want the feedback and then the grade doesn't really matter. But when you're so ingrained with that over a period of time, of course, that's going to be your focus to begin with.
Well, yeah. And they're fresh out of university, right? The people, a lot of them are pre-service teachers. A lot of them are supply teachers. And so they've just come from a faculty of ed, you know, 2 year program really has, you know, such an emphasis on grades. But I think a big part of it is the faculty of ed's put that minimum standard on, like you need to maintain your 70 to stay in the program, right? Of course. And so that creates an emphasis on that part of it, you know, and it's really hard to undo. It's a challenge for me. Because I have tried to make my adult courses gradeless, and those in the part three love it, because I think, particularly in the online forums, that the conversations we have on discussion boards are deeper without the grade. What I've noticed is if you apply a weighted grade to an online course, some of the posts become superficial because people are posting for the sake of posting, you know, and it becomes this big echo chamber, and then there's not as much depth to the conversation. So once I pulled the grades off, I found the discussion forums were tremendously better in terms of pedagogy and, you know, and teaching and learning.
So I want to go back to when you first started teaching. What grade levels did you start teaching?
I started, my first gig was a grade 5 job. After that, I taught in the K-2-3 space for a year. But most of my career, I've spent what we call intermediate years in grade 7 and 8.
So what were some of the biggest challenges as a classroom teacher for you?
Things are different here in Ontario. We stream our students in grade 9. So one of the biggest challenges for me as a grade 8 student is that grade conversation again, because we have 4 streams in our high school setting, but typically students enter applied stream, we call it, or an academic stream, which means where they're going to either workplace or college or university, because those are 2 separate things here in Canada. And so the biggest challenge as a grade 8 teacher is having a classroom full of kids, even in June, who I'm assessing and evaluating on this same standard, and then they're going off into their own unique program where they're going to be incredibly successful. I always have high school kids come back to me and say, we're doing so much better in high school, it's easier. Well, you've landed in the spot you were supposed to be in, and unfortunately in the K-8 space here, we're all in that same box. Mm-hmm. So the idea of throwing out grades and focusing on good feedback in grade 7 and 8 has there's been some pushback because our parents don't quite understand it, of course. And those that are heading into academia, they want the grades and they want quantities of homework. That, number one. And number two, the other piece, because I'm so passionate about coding and computer science, is the narrative of play. I've heard, you know, all we do is play in Mr. A's class. And I don't know where along the continuum of education play took on that negative context, because we encourage it in the young grades. So, you know, why does it stop as we go up? So I've heard, you know, all we do is play in Mr. A's class. We don't have homework. We use the textbook. So you're not preparing kids for high school. That's one of the biggest narratives I hear all the time. Drives me bonkers.
So as your time as an administrator, what did you feel was the most difficult part of transitioning from a teacher to now a leadership role?
I think in my case, it's a little bit different because I'd be a fill-in principal at the various schools I was at. And so everybody is still a colleague, you know, but one day you're working alongside your grade eight partner. And then the next day you are down in the office dealing with typically behavior issues from your own classroom because you've got a supply teacher down, you know, in your own neck of the woods. So it's that finding that balance. But I think just being approachable in any regard, I mean, just because I was in administration doesn't mean I changed how I dress. I'm still wearing a t-shirt, you know, shaving every 3 days and playing floor hockey in the gym and nothing changed.
So did it give you a different perspective, seeing kind of a global aspect instead of just being in your classroom in your own little bubble?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, right down to budget stuff and photocopy ink and this parent and that parent and food orders and this classroom's missing 3 pieces of pizza and the announcements aren't working and who's singing O Canada today, and trying to create that culture and keep all the moving parts together is definitely a big challenge.
So what do you think are some characteristics that a leader should possess to be successful?
That's a good question. See, I like that we haven't scripted this ahead of time, sort of off the cuff.
Yeah.
I think the biggest characteristic is it's something that is earned, I think. It's not something that's demanded. Just because of your title doesn't necessarily mean you're the expert. I may be the expert in coding, but I couldn't tell you a thing about the arts, you know? And I think the biggest characteristic is recognizing that you are one piece of this moving puzzle and everybody in the building is an expert in some capacity, right down to our secretaries and our custodians. And we have to utilize them, and even our students. We have to utilize those skill sets to keep the synergy, you know, keep the ship moving in the right direction.
So as a lead learner, how are you able to instill discovery and growth with your students, with your staff, and now with your adult learners?
For me, it's a modeled approach. As you know, we're connected on just about every social media channel, and I believe in the transparency. I don't have a personal Facebook, but more importantly, I think it's being transparent for our parents. I have no shame in blogging that, hey, I screwed up today. This lesson flopped. It didn't work. Here's what I think. I would try differently next time, and here's what we learned from the experience. So I think for me, it's the transparency piece, both in person and online, particularly with the digital citizenship conversation.
Let's talk about your book, Codebreaker. Where did that concept come from? And for the listeners that haven't read the book yet, what is it all about?
Well, so I studied computer science when I was in grade 8, of course. So like I said, here in Ontario, we transitioned to high school in grade 9. So when I went from 8 to 9 and I filled out my guidance form, what do you want to be when you grow up, so that my high school could kind of cater to my interests? And I wrote teacher. My mom taught English as a second language. My grandfather was a high school chemistry teacher. So, and I enjoyed school. School was fun for me. So I always had this idea of being a teacher. Now, this was in the early 90s. I started learning HTML on my own and was building websites for the mom and pop pizza shops in my community. And I thought, oh, there's opportunity here. So I graduated high school with a web portfolio in the mid 90s. And I thought, I need to go into computer science. You know, and this is right at the Y2K burst, if you will. So I studied computer science. And when I got out, where we live here in Southern Ontario, there's not a lot of opportunity in terms of, I guess we didn't call it startups 20 years ago, but in that innovative space, there wasn't a lot of opportunity. And I was not prepared to move to, say, Toronto here because the cost of living is so significantly different. So I thought, you know what? I really want to go back into education. Maybe I'll be a high school computer science teacher. Anyway, long story short, I supplied both elementary and on the secondary list after I graduated from the faculty, and I was offered a grade 5 job. And we have 2 unions here in Ontario, our elementary and our secondary space. And so the second I did not supply secondary for the course of a year, I was removed from the list. So I was forever an elementary teacher, and I have absolutely no regrets. starting off in grade 7 and 8, seeing all the math courses I took in my undergrad and the links to coding and computer science, I'll be honest, it's what I was very passionate about. So I would integrate it. And I've been doing it for 15, 20 years. The more I do it now, the further I go back to look at research. It's quite fascinating. So I've always been doing it. And as such, we know the demand for those skills has gotten greater and greater. I could never have predicted that 15 years ago when I started doing coding in my classroom. I never thought this was coming. So now being pulled in all of those directions, being asked to consult with ministries and our unions and different school boards and, you know, off to Hawaii tomorrow, the keynote conference, I thought I have to put something together to show that computer science and coding by itself doesn't just have to be in those explicit classes. I was a rotary phys ed teacher for a long time. And I remember I always coached my basketball team through simulated play and with that mindset of looking at variables. So let's pick on phys ed, for example. You're in the middle of a basketball game. What are the variables? Well, the scoreboard is a variable. The time remaining is a variable. Is it our turn to inbound the ball? That's a variable. If we're inbounding the ball underneath the opponent's basket, that's another variable. If all of these variables are true, then we will run a set determined play. And that is exactly the same mindset of a coder. It's computational thinking. So I wrote the book just to give educators entry points. I didn't want coding to be an add-on. We've got a big focus on numeracy and math, of course, globally. So I wanted it to be a supplement. You think about the SAMR model, some of the other trendy things, growth mindset, flipped classroom, genius hour, all of those pieces allow coding to be integrated almost seamlessly into existing lessons. So the book really revolves around take a lesson you already do so well, and here might be a way that you can integrate even just the terminology of computer science. Talk about Boolean logic and conditional statements and looping and things of that nature. Maybe you're exploring the game of Monopoly, or you're writing procedures in your English class. Well, you know, writing code is a set of instructions that the computer does to perform a task. So the idea for Codebreaker, in a nutshell, because I went down a big rabbit hole there, is just to show educators ways that I've used it, ways that students have challenged me. There's a lot of examples in the book of failures on my part and things that kids have done that really changed the way I think about coding and computer science. I'll give you one quick example. When I started teaching math, again, 15 years ago, of course, math was a quantity of correct answers. That's how I graded it. I didn't know any better. And I no longer think that way. But in the perfect example, having a student program, say, a probability simulator like flipping a coin, they can do it in about 4 or 5 lines of code. By dumping it into a loop, we now have a simulator that a student has created. And I've had down to grade 3 students build these kinds of apps to demonstrate theoretical probability and to demonstrate the law of large numbers, right? The more times you flip a coin, the data gets to 50-50. Well, in 5 lines of code, they can demonstrate that with a simulator. Makes it really challenging to quantify those experiences because math is no longer binary. It's no longer right or wrong. And I'll quote Seymour Papert, 1980, he wrote Mindstorms. If you look at that approach to math, it's not whether a student's solution is wrong, it's whether it's fixable. And we have to undo the mindset of that because we have this fear in education of being wrong.
You're right. We're so afraid of failure that we do everything we possibly can to get rid of it.
Yeah, well, that's just it. We preach, embrace failure and take risks. It's all I read about it on social media every day. How do we do those things in a system in which failure is punished? There's too much risk in not getting the grade.
You're obviously active on social media. You are a keynote speaker. I've seen your TED Talks and, you wrote your book, Codebreaker. How did you go beyond the campus to find your voice?
Well, it started for me in 2008. Social media was blocked. YouTube was blocked. MySpace was blocked. USB ports were blocked. We didn't want kids to upload a virus. And we have a program here in Ontario called Creating Pathways to Success. And at the time, we started the program in grade 7. It's now K-12. But at the time, in grade 7 and 8, we would have our students explore their interests so that they could start to tailor what their electives would be in high school. And a group of students said to me, like, you studied computer science. Why are you here? No offense, but why are you, a grade 8 teacher? And I remember coming back from a digital citizenship workshop, and I thought, this is fascinating because all of the social channels are blocked. We've got all kinds of policies in place that say, don't friend kids on Facebook. I mean, again, this is 12 years ago, right? A student said, could you build an app that allows us to engage outside the classroom? You know what? I think I could. So I took my two passions, coding, computer science, and education. And I built an app called Twiducate. It's actually still live today. I'm not involved in the project, but in the first 2 years, we had 150,000 users on this platform. And all it was Twitter for school, hence the name Twiducate. And it was a place for myself to engage with students beyond the classroom, but in that walled garden. So when you join the Twiducate platform, it looked like Twitter at the time, a little bit like Twitter at the time. You could only write, 140 characters, but you only followed the people in your class. And so we used it to engage during the Olympics at the time, outside of school. And all of a sudden I had TV crews in my classroom going, teacher builds app with students to teach digital citizenship. Essentially, I solved my own problem. I mean, I'm no longer involved with the project because all of our social media channels have been opened. But that's when it really started for me. From there, I was invited to speak at conferences to share the app. Not from a monetization standpoint, but like, holy cow, we've got a teacher here who's created an app with students to solve authentic problems and come and tell us about it. Not just the tool itself, but that process, modeling the trial and error with kids and all the curriculum that came from it. Like, we're graphing stats hit on the website, where they came from all over the world. So from there, it evolved into speaking at conferences, being asked to. And has morphed today to, the consulting piece, because computational thinking as a fundamental skill is so incredibly important. But yeah, a lot of it really came from one of my first classrooms.
For those starting their educational or leadership journey, what advice do you have for them?
It's okay to be where you are. It's not okay to stay there. Not be expert in the room. It's the room itself that is the expert. The synergy of the people, the synergy of the ideas. There's all, countless graphics on the internet, the difference between a boss and a leader. And it's true, leaders are driving the ship, but they're not captain of the ship per se, where everybody else is pulling the ship along.
In closing, what do you think is the most joyful thing about being a leader?
Oh, there's a lot. The most joyful thing, I think, is just seeing the smiles, seeing the smiles among staff, seeing the smiles among students, seeing the smiles among parents. It's that pat on the back, I guess, when you see those examples, that you're on the right path. And if people are happy, then learning will happen.
And Brian, how can our listeners connect with you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Aspinall. I'm also on Instagram at Mr. Aspinall. And you can find me on my blog at brianaspinall.com.
Please continue to check out the Aspire podcast on SoundCloud and iTunes and share your ratings and reviews. Don't forget to use the Aspire Lead hashtag as you continue the conversation on Twitter. Brian, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.